Hello, everyone. I'm Barbara Peters, and I've gathered together today two friends and experts, so to speak, or we're making ourselves experts on the subject of the Gothic. What is the Gothic? Is it making a comeback? What are the characteristics that apply, and who's actually writing Gothics, and so forth? And this started because I think the Gothic is the next big thing, or I thought that was true about 2 years ago. And then Jane Ann Krentz, who's with us today, and JT Ellison reinforced all that. Jane Ann and I started discussing it when she hosted an event for Carol Johnston called Mirrorland. And then JT actually wrote a book that applies to this called Her Dark Lies that we talked about. So maybe we'll just get into it that way. Jane Ann, talk to us a bit about Mirrorland and why it is that you and I got going on this whole Gothic kick in the first place.
Well, it probably wasn't our first Gothic. We just weren't calling it that until recently. And then I think it dawned on us that we're old enough to be, we know some of these tropes. We've seen some of these classic setups and we love them. And they haven't been around for a while. Now I think it's going under the name psychological suspense, but I think it's Gothic. And Mirrorland was a particularly interesting example. For one thing, Carol Johnston, the author, is from the UK, which is sort of the home of the classic Gothic novel. And she had what I think a requirement is for authors, which you have, JT, absolutely, a real gift for description and narrative. I think that's key to writing the Gothic. Probably why I will never actually do one, because I love them, but I don't think I have the voice for it. I suck at narrative and description.
I could not disagree with you more. Okay. We can circle back to that, but I have something to say on that.
Yeah.
By the way.
Go. Well,
okay, I will do this now. I think you do. I think you absolutely do. Any of the historicals, automatically they already have it. You've already got the house, you've already got the brooding character, you've already got the ingenue, you already have a lot of those tropes. And I think you sell yourself short when you say that you don't have the voice of that, because honestly, it crumbles a little bit more, it gets a little bit darker, and boom, you're there. So
well, thank you very much, but your well, Good Girls Lie, and then your latest, Her Dark Lies, that you just finished, are absolutely brilliant examples of, they're the brilliant examples of the what I think of as the modern Gothic. It isn't just the house, it isn't just, it's the way you unfold the mystery. And you don't cheat in the sense that it's an unreliable narrator. The narrator is honest as the narrator can be with the information she has at that point. And that's, so the reader learns, uncovers the mystery at the same time the narrator does. And I think that's key to the enjoyment of the books for me. It's not all of a sudden we just find out there's a repressed memory and nobody can remember, you know, what happened in the childhood. I like the mystery to be honest in the sense that it unfolds to the reader at the same time it does to the narrator. So,
or and the protagonist. Do you feel like it has to have an unreliable narrator? I mean, is that the hallmark of the more modern Gothic, is the absolute unreliable narrator that seems to be popping up everywhere?
No, I don't think so. I think the Gothic to some degree is an extension of the whole Gone Girl scenario. Let me give you an historical background. Before Cox went down and my whole internet collapsed, I was able to consult a couple of historical sources. I hate it when that happens. Don't you feel defenseless? Anyway, one thing describes Gothic as a genre of literature and film that covers horror, death, and at times romance, but I think it's much broader than that. And it's said to derive from the English author Horace Walpole's 1764 novel, which is a real classic, The Castle of Otranto, which was later captioned a Gothic story, and is the direct ancestor, really, of Edgar Allan Poe's The Fall of the House of Usher. And I can say that the recent equivalent of that is a book by Martin Edwards called Mortmain Hall. The second in his Rachel Sabernick series, which I'm the editor. And it is just a straightforward, almost progression and Mark Main Hall ends up in a classic estate on a crumbling cliff in Yorkshire. And at the end, sorry, there are spoilers, but it's been out for a while, whole thing goes over the cliff, you know? I mean, it's like the Manderley burning or the fall of the House of Usher. And another source says that the Gothic, the characteristics include death and decay, haunted homes and castles, family curses, madness, powerful love, romance, ghosts, and vampires. And I think that's an older definition. I think that the modern Gothic has more interesting stuff going on. And so maybe we ought to define what those elements are. And I would say that it's often, I think, at the moment being confused with Agatha Christie, that because of the, you know, the house and the castle, and because Agatha Christie, you know, did so well with the country house murder, that same enclosure, if you think about Rebecca, it really didn't work without the house, right? Manderley. And Mort Main Hall similarly doesn't. So I think people are confusing what was actually in some cases an Agatha Christie story with a Gothic. So the question is, how much of those classic Gothic elements have to come into Agatha Christie in order to make it more of a modern Gothic?
I think the key is that it has to be an intimate kind of threat. It's coming from within, either within the house or within the family or within the group that's locked together. As they were in Agatha Christie, but the intimacy and knowing the threat is right there, you know, right near you, and you have, if you're going to survive, you have to identify it. But it's intimate, it's personal. That's to me part of what works.
I agree. And Then There Were None is a really great example of, okay, we are in a closed circle mystery, right? We're stuck in a place. So it has part of the elements of isolation and the house, but it's not that intimate threat. You're not there thinking with, even though there is this huge threat and everybody knows it and people are dying, that is the difference. There's not that sense of, oh my gosh, the dread and the tension and the background. The ghost is a really good example. You know, there's something in that element that just elevates this up to a different plane. No pun intended. Pun intended.
I agree. I think it has something to do with the threat from within the family, mm-hmm. or within intimate. It isn't just strangers on a train kind of thing. That's the lock. That's what you're talking about, Barbara. That's that locked room mystery, strangers on a train kind of thing, or whatever. I shouldn't go there, but. Because I don't know enough about Agatha Christie, but the intimacy of the family drama, the haunting from the past, the pulling in whatever dark secrets happened in the past is what's going to affect the present. That's a little different, I think.
Well, yeah, I think dark secrets work in the same way that supernatural. I think it's a mistake to think of the modern Gothic as really a horror story. But I was thinking about JT's book, because really what we're seeing is that the house can be anything. In your case, it's an island. And it, you know, it could be a cabin on a cruise ship. It could be as long as it's got sort of a non-permeable border so that the story is contained within it, you can translate the classic house, the castle, to nearly any environment, which is also true really of an Agatha Christie story. You can take the country house and you can make it nearly anything. You can make it a theater. Niall Marsh used to do it, you know, as a theater and so forth. So JT, when you were writing Her Dark Lies, did you even think of the word Gothic?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is an homage to Rebecca without any reservation. And now that we are so far away from the publication, no spoilers, so don't listen if you don't want to know this. I was reading Rebecca when I was thinking about this book, and the most basic question hit me, what if Rebecca hadn't died? What if Rebecca wasn't dead? What if, you know, she was literally not a ghost, but she was there in the house trying to drive our unnamed narrator crazy? Oh my gosh. And that's what I was doing. It was a response to that question. So yes, we have the house, we have the island, we have the wealthy family, we have the ingenue coming into this family. Everybody has secrets. and there's a storm and they're stuck on the island. And of course there's a wedding and all of that. But I was absolutely shooting for that. I wanted it to land squarely in the Gothic thriller genre. And what we were talking about, Barbara, a while ago is that part of the new modern Gothic is they've gone international to these different settings instead of it just being that, you know, British country house kind of feeling on the moors. You know, it's spread out.
Absolutely. Well, actually, crime fiction has gone global in various genres. I mean, it was really mostly an American and British form when it started out, Victorian times, whether it's Wilkie Collins and A Novel of Sensation or eventually Agatha Christie and so forth. But yeah, I think one of the great things about the present crime scene is that the works are coming in from all over. I mean, we've been doing Zooms with German authors and Icelandic authors and, you know, French. I mean, that's a great thing about Zooms. You can go anywhere. I'm waiting for the Indian Gothic or the Thai Gothic, or, you know, it's going to come our way. And, you know, and I was thinking about Du Maurier because, yeah, we all think of Rebecca as kind of the prototype Gothic for today. But what about Jamaica Inn? What about Frenchman's Creek or My Cousin Rachel, which probably was her best known second novel? You know, are those Gothics or are those more just novels of suspense like The Woman in White?
I vote that they're more suspense, especially My Cousin Rachel, because it's, you know, that's got an external threat. I think part of the Gothic, the true Gothic, is the internal threat. It's what Jane Anne was saying. It's that internal intimacy that really separates it out. I mean, My Cousin Rachel is a great example of it could have been, but the threat's from outside instead of inside. Yeah. Gotta be in the house.
I agree. I mean, I think it's a mistake to just type Du Maurier as a Gothic writer was why I brought that up, you know. I mean, you call yourself thriller chick, you're a thriller writer, but here we're talking about you writing a Gothic, but that doesn't type you. And then Jane Anne is already saying, you know, she isn't writing Gothics and you think she is, and so do I. So
yeah.
Writer, know thy own work may be the message of this whole thing. But
and sometimes that's the hardest thing to do is figure out what your real core story is. Other people see it and you don't. It's kind of a weird thing about writing. Yeah,
but isn't it fun not to write to type? I mean, I think it's wonderful to have the freedom, you know, to write whatever you want. What I find interesting is not only has it gone international, but what we're now seeing are whole subgenres of so there's a book coming out in October I mentioned to you both yesterday, which is a Gothic fantasy horror book called The Death of Jane Lawrence, which I haven't read at all. But what was interesting is in the write-up, the pitch from the publisher about it, it specifically uses the word Gothic, you know, Gothic horror. So that's one. Now, there's another book that I just happen to have right here, which came my way, called River Sing Out by James Wade. Now, his first book, which I really liked, just won the, Reading the West Award for last year. It was a really solid Western, and I liked it a lot. This one, the description says, it's a Southern Gothic odyssey, attempting to escape his abusive father and generations of cyclical poverty. Young Jonah Hargrove joins the mysterious river, a teenage girl carrying thousands of dollars in stolen meth and embarks on a Southern Gothic odyssey through the Texas river bottoms. Now, that seems to me be kind of a stretch. And I'm beginning to wonder if Gothic is becoming just kind of a buzzword, you know, and it may not really apply in the way that we would think of it to this particular book.
That people are reading it into things that we wouldn't consider classic Gothic or even the new. I don't think it was classic Gothic. I think it's we're inventing. I think writers right now are inventing the new Gothic. My theory, which I know you agree with, is that old genres never die. They just get reinvented with each new generation. And that's what makes them fresh, is that new take on them. But the Southern Gothic that phrase has been used for years in a way that I think is different.
Okay.
I don't know how to explain it. I just think of, when I hear Southern Gothic, I have another image in my mind, not what I would consider the Gothic novel. And I really can't even explain why. I just
don't know. What do you see? Do you see sort of decaying mansions and hanging moss and
I see a heritage from the past that inflicts itself on the present, and it's all in the family. That part would feel Gothic to me, but it to me it really is a Southern story. You know what? It fits in that world, and it wouldn't fit out here on the West Coast, for example. But I can't even tell you why I wouldn't define it that way. You're probably better at it than I am when it comes to drawing the lines, but.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm totally fluid. You know, the Poison Pen only has one shelving deal. We don't even think about genres. We just put all the books in alphabetically in rows on shelves and let them speak for themselves. What do you think, JT? What does Southern Gothic say to you?
It's really interesting because I edited an anthology of folks. The anthology is called Dead End Stories from the Gothic South, right? It's about a house. I gave everybody the photograph of a house because I wanted to prove that if you have 10 authors and you have one story, they're going to tell it 10 different ways. So I recruited a bunch of people. I gave them this, and here is this old crumbly house. And it is an old crumbly house. Write me a Southern Gothic story. And it had to be set in the South. And I think really that's probably the only thing about a Southern Gothic is that it needs to be set in the South. Because from the description that you just read.
I'd really have to think about it. I agree with Jane Ann that it's almost always going to be family driven.
It's
going to be an intimate story. You know, and rooted, I think, in the past. I mean, does really the story origin, do you think, have to bubble up out of the past? I mean, you don't walk into a room and see a body and then call it a Gothic.
No, oh, good point. I think you're right. I think it is tied to the ghosts, whether real or defined, haunting it, the current family in the house is whatever it is. The protagonists, they're being haunted by something and it comes from the past. It feels like that's part of the story to me.
Well, do you think it kind of makes me wonder if the Gothics that we traditionally term Gothic, the houses are 10 times older than the houses in the American South, right? The houses themselves are so much older. So maybe even visually, that signal is being sent that it's an ancestral problem that you're going to be tackling because the manse or the castle or the house is somehow crumbling and going away and falling down and you have to go in and save it in some ways.
So when you were writing Her Dark Lies, you knew going in you were going to have to take it out of the US and into how did you pick the location? That must have been a process.
I created it. It's the first time I ever created a location. But I made it. And merged them together and pushed it off into the Tyrrhenian Sea where it couldn't be accessible by anything but ferry, yacht, or helicopter. And because I knew I wanted to have this big storm and I wanted to have the big cliff and just the visuals of this place. Inside, it's an incredibly modern house. So it's got that kind of, Ruth Ware just did a book that's truly a Gothic, but it is a very modern environment. And that's what this has. It has a modern environment, but there's a crypt underneath the house. And there are tunnels and there's a labyrinth and there's cottage, you know, the whole shebang. I kind of kitchen sinked it a little bit, but you know, it was fun. it's got a little bit of everything.
So maybe what we're talking about here is a sense of claustrophobia.
Thank you.
Something that, like a tunnel, a crypt.
Right. And it doesn't, in the modern iteration, it doesn't actually need vampires. It doesn't need to be Dracula or Strigoi, as we say in Transylvania. I'm doing Laurie King's Queen of Romania book on Saturday, and we went to Transylvania together and went to Bran's castle, which of course never saw, right. I mean, the whole thing was made up by a tourist guy, as it all turns out. But now people flock to Bran Castle, which is really not a particularly extraordinary castle, but sits up on a giant rock thing and looms. So that makes it interesting. But, you know, I think classic Gothics very often did have supernatural creatures. But I have this kind of thought that really, once the Gone Girl and the Trust No One God thing got going, that, that pushed us towards the modern Gothic, because what you had were untrustworthy narrators and untrustworthy characters, which is not the case in a police procedural or whatever, where in theory you're supposed to be able to at least trust the sleuth. Although occasionally we find, well, you know, Christie did that first with the murder of Roger Ackroyd and, you know, the unreliable narrator. But we've seen examples of that since. So I'm wondering if this trend towards the Gothic really is an extension of Trust No One.
I think it is. Jane Ann, what about you?
Yeah, I think the Trust No One thing is what lends to the intimacy of it, because these are people you should be able to trust, or you have to trust because of the situation, and you can't. You don't dare trust anybody. And I think that's what puts the pressure on the protagonist and puts the stress into the story. I read, hello, my name is Jane, and I'm addicted to Gothic novels now. And my gateway novel was Silvia Moreno Garcia's Mexican Gothic, which I admit I bought because of the cover.
It's an awesome cover.
It is an awesome
cover. I have it right here.
I would have killed for that cover. but it was particularly interesting to me because it does glide into horror, but it's modern day horror in the sense that there's a realistic, I had just finished lots of books on mushrooms, so I recognized there was
natural extension, right?
It was a natural extension. So I think that's what she was using, really, instead of ghosts or the traditional horror things. And it worked. For me, it really worked. But I also liked the protagonist. She was a heroic character. She was gonna figure this out and save her cousin, and she does. And I like that.
Well, a lot of Hispanic literature, especially South American, you know, has magical realism in it, which isn't really Gothic, but nonetheless would lead people to accept supernatural forces or something, you know, in books. Or you could just throw in hallucinogens or whatever, you know, whatever you wanted. Does there have to be a murder in a book to make it a Gothic? Does it have to be a murder mystery?
I think so.
I think it makes it more interesting, more nuanced. I mean, any book that's going to be looking at that, you know, through that lens of, oh, now somebody's dead and who did it? I mean, that's the Christie element to the Gothic, right? If you've got somebody who's dying.
But you know what you could add? You could add that would work too, or does work, is the gaslighting thing where you're trying to drive a character mad. I think that pulls the same energy.
Oh, and so now you've circled, I want to go back to claustrophobia in a minute, but you just circled into one of my favorites, which is yellow wallpaper. I feel like that's a Gothic. And I think it's the madness, the element of trying to drive her crazy that really, I think that's something that is part of these stories, that there's some force, be it ghost, be it supernatural, be it the caretaker, the, you know, whoever, that villain is that force that's trying to destabilize the character. And the destabilization, that feels very Gothic to me.
Yes, and it's also very threatening, because everybody fears, that's an elemental fear for everybody, you know, mm-hmm. Who's in your mind, and did I really have that dream? You know, did I really see that? So you're tapping into a real, that's as big a threat as murder.
Yeah, for sure.
No, I think it is too. We come back to The Woman in White. You know, you can call it a novel of sensation, but you could also call it a Gothic, I think, reasonably so. And, you know, I was thinking, we've talked about the Southern Gothic. I love the idea that in the Southern Gothic Odyssey, the East Texas river bottoms could substitute for the house, which I think is really, you know, but why not? And then we have the Western Gothic. We've had the fantasy Gothic. There are science, I'm sure I sent you, or maybe I saw a science fiction Gothic. And then I was thinking Deanna Rayburn and her Veronica Speedwell series, maybe two books back or three. I can't remember the title at the moment. And I don't have Patrick to rescue me, as I often do when he's doing these with us. But it takes place on an island.
And it's really, isn't it?
Sorry?
It's Treacherous Curse, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and it's got all those elements in it. You know, you've got the isolation, you've got the family thing, you've got somebody trying to, you know, be driven mad, you've got a murder. I mean, so you have, in other words, the historical Gothic is where I was going with this. You know, you can write a modern Gothic, but you can make it historical if you just set it back. I've got another one here, which I just picked up. By what's her name here, Clara McKenna, called Murder in Key Haven Castle. And it's a cozy, but maybe there's, you know, like a cozy Gothic, which this may not qualify since I haven't read it yet. But what I like is the fluidity of Gothic, you know, because here we're saying you can apply it to all these different already established subgenres, but then it seems to give it a slightly different spin. So you mentioned the Gothic thriller as for Her Dark Lies. I wouldn't have thought of putting those two words together until recently, would you?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I was trying to do, is make it, and we should probably define also the difference between a suspense and a thriller, and a mystery and a thriller, and at its most basic, in a thriller, the reader knows more about what's happening than the character, and in a mystery, the reader and the character are finding things out together. So when I say a Gothic thriller, I mean that the reader's gonna know what's going on. I mean, more than the characters. The characters are kind of lost, people are dying, they don't know what's happening, but the reader knows who is behind it. And that's the difference to me. And that's what I was trying to do. I don't know if it succeeded or not, but that's definitely what I was trying to do. So the reader understands where things are coming from, and the characters they're rooting for the characters, but are they going to write the right ones?
So in a thriller, if you think of it as like the serial killer thriller, there's always scenes in the head of the killer. Always seeing the awfulness from the killer's point of view, and the characters are trying. Yeah. So that may be a good definition of thriller, where you do kind of know what's going on with the bad guys. It's not uncovering that secret. That's the mystery. That's interesting. I like that. That's a good definition.
Well, I mean, a mystery is basically about whodunit. It's a process of investigation. And a thriller is really about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a moving target, and the reader knows from the outset that somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose, which is a different, you wouldn't introduce, you know, like a clue finder or a puzzle aspect into a thriller instead, you know. And in a thriller, really, don't you think in a thriller that the villain has to bear the same weight as the protagonist? In a mystery, oftentimes the Christie killers or even the victims were not that well delineated. But in a thriller, if you don't have a great villain, you know, an antagonist, they don't really work if it's just some weak character. It has to be a real contest.
The contest, and that's it. It's the antagonist and the protagonist and the hero and the villain, and they're going head to head. Not to pull us from books, but if you've been watching Mayor of Easttown, oh my goodness, perfect murder mystery. It's a mystery. There are so many people that could be the killer. And that to me, that's the quintessential mystery. Is the options are endless as to who it could be. And you've got to figure that out. And hopefully you figure it out, you know, at the same time as the character, you're not ahead of it. But that thriller, you know who that killer is, you know who it is. And it's the head to head. That's exactly it.
Right. And that sort of carries over to the spy story too, if you really think about it. The spy mm-hmm. story sometimes is more like a whodunit, i.e., you know, who's the mole in the CIA or, right. You know, whatever it is. But spy stories can also be thrillers. You know, you've got the Spetsnaz guy over here and you've got, you know, the whatever it is over here. And who's going to outwit whom? Alma Katsu just read a really good book called Red Widow, and Beatrice Williams has a new one out called Our Woman in Moscow, which I think is a better book than the review, at least the first review I read, allows, if you really dig into it. I think it's a very clever plot. But again, it's got a real whodunit. It's got a thriller aspect because you've got, you know who the KGB woman is, Ludmilla, and all the rest of it. But it also has a whodunit element because you're not sure who the mole, who's really, you know, betraying whom.
But at the heart of the story are the sisters.
That's right. It's a family. Yep. So in a way, it's a gothic thriller spy story if we want to really do. I love that.
Well, then aren't we starting to get into the point of view situation? So a gothic would have fewer points of view. It'd be for that intimacy, and the thriller has multiple points of view from, you know, all the different characters. Does that make any difference in the gothic feel of things? How many characters you're hearing from?
I think that's an important element in somewhere along the line, because I'm always fighting to keep the number of characters down so that I don't have lots of different points of view. I want the intimacy. I want the two people at the center of my books, which are usually always romantic suspense. I want those two people to be under a threat from equal threat from both sides, and they can't know what's going on. So I think you have a point there that's an important element.
Yeah. Does it have to be third person or first person, or can you mix it up? Does it really, what do you think? I'm trying to remember, is Rebecca that in third person? It is, isn't it? Mrs. Mm-hmm. It refers to her as Mrs. DeWinter. It's not Mrs. DeWinter saying I all the way through. I also think one of the brilliances of Rebecca is that Mrs. DeWinter is so anonymous. You know, she's just Mrs. DeWinter. She never gets a name.
Do you know how hard that is to do? I tried and failed. I tried it and it just, she did something so special with that book, because to have an anonymous narrator like that, that you are so involved with and so rooting for, and you want things to be right for her, it's incredibly hard to do. And I think part of it is how she says, you know, last night I went to Manderley again. So it is in first person. And, you know, she sets that up so incredibly well with the house that the character can slide in and be this anonymous little mouse on the, you know, basically the fly on the wall who's watching what's happening, right? She's the observer of everything that's going on, and it's happening to her as well. It's hard. I couldn't do it. I had to go back in and put names in. I may try it again, but I gave up. It's difficult.
That's true. It does start out. Last night I dreamt to Manderley. I went to Manderley again. When is it? The rhododendrons are in bloom. And so that definitely is a first person thing, but I'm trying to remember if it switches or whether it's her all the way through narrating it. It's been so long since I read it. I honestly can't remember. And I brought that up because I had a question. Is it?
It is first person, yeah.
All the way through?
Mm-hmm. It is.
And for a long time for a long time that first person became part of the core story for the Gothic. Gothics I grew up on were all first person. The protagonist told the story along to us.
Right. And yet when you, and it's even true of Deanna's book, you know, because Veronica narrates those books. But, and in Mirrorland, we heard from the twin, right? It was her first person voice.
The main character that we start with, that's her voice throughout the book. Yeah, that's who, yeah.
Right. But in the Martin Edwards book, Mort Main Hall, which is a wonderful Gothic, it is third person.
Oh, interesting.
All the way through. So maybe it doesn't, you know, maybe you can, again, it's a fluid form. Maybe you can choose as the author, you know, which seems like the more authentic voice for you. And also, I think you've probably both seen this. Maybe you actually do it. You can switch from first to third person in books today without. I had a really interesting discussion with J.A. Jantz like last night when we, Tuesday night, when we launched your book, where she brought J.P. Beaumont into another series. And the series she brought him into was all third person, but Beaumont had always been first person. And when she tried to write him as third person, she just couldn't do it.
Oh,
just could not do it. Her editor at Simon & Schuster didn't like that and changed him all to third person. And when she got it back, she said he was so dead on the page, she was either going to have to kill the book or, you know, go back and put him back into first person again. And Stevenson did that in Treasure Island, if you go and read it. He switched from third to first person and back because he couldn't make the story work. And I think readers are okay with that. You know, sometimes you need to give them like cues in the production of the manuscript so they don't get completely lost about who's talking. But mm-hmm. most of the time, if it's third person and then first, the reader can keep up with that. And I think that readers are getting more used to it. So maybe a Gothic can do both.
Well, I do know that in Carol Johnston's book, the way she handled it was she had the other character, the other sister speaking to her in the form of journal diaries, diaries and letters. That's another way of incorporating that other character into the story without taking away the focus on the main protagonist.
Absolutely, and you see it now too where people use text. You know, or email in the story. I mean, you've got journals, but I have read a couple where, you know, you just have a text message inserted or journals. And I'm trying to remember, there's an author who was really, I'll think of her in a minute. She actually used the chapter headings, the section headings with the email moniker. She's a really popular author. I don't know why I'm having this blank, but the whole thing was done. The whole story was more or less written in email, sort of like Jane Austen, you know, and her Lady Susan, when it was all less letters, the epistolary novel.
I love epistolary.
And Pamela, the first novel in English, really, by Richardson, was written as an epistolary novel, just all letters back and forth. So you always knew who was speaking because of the heading and the signature. And you could do that with email as well. So I like that the Gothic can be adapted to modern technology as well. Have you used that, JT, in any of your thrillers? Have you used like text or email inserts or whatever?
Yeah, I think So Close to Hand of Death started all of the killers are sending emails. I was just double checking because I was pretty sure Her Dark Lies. I wanted to double check. I used two first person narrators and then third person for all the other characters.
Right. I thought I remembered. Yeah, because you had to write.
Yeah, I was just double checking because I'm so far away from this now. It's like, wait a minute, I did do two first person, but I didn't label it. And I think that's, you know, that was the obscuring part. But yeah, I love the putting the modern technology in. I mean, I don't know about you, but the cell phone has ruined the novel in my mind, because we can just pick up the phone and find out the truth and walk away, right? So I'm always trying to find ways to either limit the technology, which is what I was doing with Her Dark Lies, putting it on the island without a storm so they wouldn't be able to just, you know, call for help and that kind of thing. But I totally agree.
Really,
oh, totally agree. It's how do you not pick up the phone, right?
It's one of the reasons I like doing the 1930s setting under Amanda Quick, because I don't have to worry about that. I don't have to worry about sophisticated forensics. I don't have, you know, everything goes back to the Sherlock Holmes solving the crime through just intelligence. And I love that part. And I still think that's the bottom line for most people. I don't think most readers want the total crime solved by DNA. That's for court proof. But that's not how you make the arrest. You know, the arrest is because you figured it out and you know who's the bad guy. That's what people want, I think.
But, you know, part of the, you know, the impact of the Gothic and the, you know, the house and whatever it is there a sense of isolation, and you lose that With cell phones, we now expect everybody to be instantly accessible, which is hard. And yet, you know, if you watch any, I watched a lot of British crime shows during the pandemic and Zoom, because, you know, I run out of screen time and reading time, and then I just want to sit and be entertained. And increasingly, their police investigations are all cell phone technology. They can ping, so to speak, everybody. And so the lesson for those is, if you're going out and commit a crime, leave your phone at home, which apparently the rioters at the Capitol forgot about as well, you know, because they all carried their cell phones in. And in fact, here we had Scottsdale looters during a spell before, not the George Floyd verdict, but when all that started over, I think it was last June, maybe a year ago. And because they all had their cell phones with them, and many of them were taking photos and putting it on social media, it was really kind of a no-brainer, you know, for the cops to identify them. And they all seem amazed, you know, that they've been that they've been caught. So if you're trying to write the kind of story we're talking about, you know, maybe the simple answer is just to have them leave their cell phone somewhere else. Otherwise, you know, you're either underground or there's a storm, or you know, you have to disable the cell phone. I mean, Linda Fairstein and I talked about that once in one of her books. The only way she could do it was to put her characters in the tunnel under Central Park, connecting the Natural History Museum and the museum, the Metropolitan Museum, you know, because if the cell phones had been live, nothing could happen, but when they were underground. But increasingly, cell phone technology can even go through tunnels and other stuff, so.
Now I want to go and look and see if anybody has used the cell phone successfully as a legal defense, because it strikes me that because the cell phone is so ubiquitous now, that if somebody is accused of murder and their alibi is the cell phone is at the house, they've tracked it, that person hasn't left the house, is that enough circumstantial evidence to mess with a case being convicted? Now I got to go and look this up, because now I'm curious.
It's actually come up in a couple of crime shows, and you know, and then the question is, was the character at home, or was the character smart enough to leave the cell phone at home? Right. So you still need,
but really legally,
an eyewitness.
Fictionally, legally, is that something that we can base off of or not?
Well, you can locate them where they shouldn't be.
Right.
If you're using it as an alibi, you almost need an eyewitness to go with it. You know, if the phone itself, because is not really going to be enough. And that's also true with computers. You know, they're using just working on a computer as an alibi also. If you can locate the laptop or the standalone computer in this room, and you know it's being used, that argues that the character was not over in the neighboring village, you know, slitting somebody's throat. But if you were really a great computer programmer, you could probably have worked out something. And so you still need an eyewitness to verify that. But it does work in terms of saying, okay, why was this character down at the warehouse on the dock when so-and-so was murdered, and we know he was there by his cell phone? And they also use CCTV in a way that we absolutely cannot do. And I also wonder if the Gothic might be under attack if the house or the castle was thoroughly ringed with cameras. I mean, think about it, you know, how would Manderley really work if in fact there had been cameras in every room? So if you want to write a really modern Gothic, how do you do that? Do you have people who aren't security conscious? You know, do you cut the security system? What do you do? Wasn't there a TV adaptation of And Then There Were None recently where they did actually have cameras and they had to work around it? I think I saw one. Maybe I'm just imputing the camera. Back to the historical Gothic. You know, maybe it's easier to write it if you just write it before 1990.
For sure, you don't have to. Yeah, but JT, you did find a way. And those authors who have been doing them in the Swiss Alps lately,
the sanatorium.
Two or three, all of the same, in the Swiss Alp and the ski lodge up on the mountain where nobody else can get, in the snowstorm. I mean, it's pure Christie all over again, right?
So authors are finding a way, but they're probably it's a bit of a stretch now to find a way to isolate your characters.
Yeah, that's right. Ruth Ware's book was really very good as a Gothic there, but and there was a debut almost at the same time by another British writer who did the same thing, except she put them in the French Alps. Or maybe, which one is Ruth? Is she in the French Alps or the Swiss? She's in Switzerland, isn't she? I think. And the other author's in the French Alps, or it's vice versa.
She's in Switzerland and Sarah's in the French Alps. No, yeah. It's backward. I'm backward. I think I'm backward.
Well, whatever.
There's a shocker.
It's another example that a health spa or a ski chalet, you know, can become a Gothic background, you know, and you can isolate people using the weather and the geography if you want to do that. But again,
Ruth did it on a ship. I mean, that was brilliant.
It was good. But you know, also if you really think about what's One by One is the title of Ruth's book, I think. In a way, it's an Agatha Christie book. It's an and then there, you know, it's an and then there were none sort of book combined with a Gothic. I mean, and that's great too when you can, you know, use techniques or tropes for more than one kind of book and blend them together to make something more interesting.
I think that's kind of. I think that's why I'm looking for more of that Gothic thriller that. Like you're doing, JT, because I like that more modern kind of threat. I suppose maybe that's it. You know, that people getting blown up and stuff like that. Action threat. And I really enjoyed Mexican Gothic. I think because of that modern horror. You know, modern horror usually is the serial killer. That's our version of modern, or it's what we've had for the past 20 years, 30 years, as our monster in the closet sort of thing. So the Gothic novel offers a chance to find another kind of horror story, and they're always going to be with us. You know, we love horror stories, so.
We like being scared. I mean, especially when we're safe. You know, that's been one of the hard parts about the pandemic, I think, that, you know, we already didn't feel safe. And so maybe scaring ourselves was not the thing that we most wanted while all that was going on, but.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the pandemic, circling back to that claustrophobia thing, I'm really curious to see what happens with everybody starting to emerge, because I think there's probably going to be a lot of Gothics that were written during this time because of the claustrophobia that everybody was feeling being stuck in their houses. And will the readers attach themselves to that, or are they going to want to stretch their wings and be away from that feeling? You know, will it be nostalgic or will it be traumatic for them? I have no idea the answer to that, Barbara. That's going to be your homework to figure that out for us.
I think it's a real question. And we've talked to so many, we've talked to hundreds of authors during the pandemic. Almost everybody is really skirting it. Nobody that we have spoken to has really embraced it. I mean, it's crept into a few books. A few authors have... I mean, some authors have decided or had already had their books that are now out written before the pandemic, and so it didn't come up. Michael Connelly kind of brushed it by ending it up in March. I think there will be some books coming out next year that the author will have to decide whether, because if they're writing in real time, whether they need to at least reference the pandemic, even if it isn't, or COVID isn't part of the story. But I think a lot of people would like not to write about it at all for a while. And part of it is because we don't know how it's going to come out. It's hard to write about something as slippery as this, you know, when anything you say may turn out to be completely wrong. A year or so down the road.
I'm not going there. I'm just like, it never happened. Just moving right along. And I take my cue from how people handled the 1918 flu.
Yeah.
Everybody put it in the rear view mirror as fast as they could. And I never heard my grandparents speak of it, even though they all lived through it. Frank never heard his grandparents speak of it, even though he had a big family back there, you know, at the time. They just never talked about it. It was like it never happened.
I don't think that's possible in an age of social media. I mean, everywhere we look, there are mass people, you know, there are memories that I don't think we can escape. So I think your question is a terrific one, JT, and I wish I had some sort of feel for it. What I have a feeling for at the moment is avoidance, but that doesn't mean that will be true once we get to 2022 books, you know, we'll just have to see how it all works on the minds of authors and what readers are going to be comfortable with. That's another real question. I mean, we've been asked, we're actually doing our first live event on July 6th. And I've got some book for fall. And you know, one of the big questions is how readers are going to feel about coming. You know, it's not just about the author and the author's comfort level or the staff's comfort level. It's also going to be, are readers really going to want to come back and crowd into the store? And, you know, so we're doing the July 6th one. We're just letting 25 people in, the first 25 who buy the book. And we're asking them to come masked because we haven't got any way to tell who's been vaccinated and who isn't. And none of us want to play policeman. So the author and I will be unmasked at a distance, and the audience is going to have to be masked. And how long will that last? And will people want to come and sit there for an hour with a mask on to listen to a conversation? I don't know. You know, but I can't just like peel it all away and say, okay, we're going to pretend none of this matters and everybody can just show up and, you know, we'll cram 200 people into the store without masks and it'll all be fine. I mean, I'm not ready to go there, nor is my staff, I might say. And probably not you authors. Why would you want to do that? So, you know, I don't know how any of us are going to come out of this, but there's certainly a gothic-y feeling to all of it. So, you know, we'll see.
Right?
There'll probably be a lot of nonfiction. You know, maybe fiction will kind of skirt it, but my guess is that there will be both nonfiction and maybe the whole self-help and the memoir. You know, things that people will write, those, how I lived through the pandemic with my three children while working full time, or, you know, things like that. The Wall Street Journal had a thing today about small business startups during the pandemic, how there are so many more of them. And one of the ones they featured was a woman who you know, suddenly found herself making masks and making a killing. Well, is that really going to last, or is that like, you know, a very short-term business plan? Because are people really going to want to, you know, to wear masks much? On the other hand, all the data is that we're all healthier. We didn't get the flu. There was a big article about childhood diseases have dropped as much as 75% because of masks and sanitizing and all, you know, measles and the rotavirus virus and all this other stuff. Are we going to be like the Japanese and accept masking in public and in our hands to stay healthier, or are we all going to just go, you know, it's over? I don't know. I mean, I really don't know, but there's certainly evidence that wearing a mask is safer regardless of COVID.
Sure. I mean, knock on wood, I haven't had a cold in a year and a half.
I've got friends who say they're going to keep up with the masking for the unforeseeable future because they've enjoyed going through 18 months with
right.
No other problem.
Exactly. No, you know, airplanes are, and I'm a tremendous cruise ship. I mean, Rob and I have cruised all over the world. We really, every ocean, well, we've even been into the Indian Ocean. Think about it. We've been to Antarctica. We've been everywhere on cruise ships. And now I don't want to go on a cruise ship. Mm-mm. I just don't, you know.
I flew last week, but masked. I mean, and I'm vaccinated, but I'm not going to sit in a small and closure with a bunch of people. And that's, I mean, so that's the question. Do readers want the gothic? Are they going to want that small, intimate, claustrophobic feeling? Or are they going to want to spread their wings? And we're going to see international thrillers become all the rage now because nobody wants that intimacy anymore.
Oh, great. This is, I'm getting set to actually write a gothic.
It's not going away, Jaden. I mean, things don't disappear, but I'll tell you what's interesting.
You told me I had the talent for a gothic, and now you tell me it's going to be a dead end.
No. I think it's going to keep going, personally.
I think it will keep going. What I do find interesting and sort of creepy is that I have two this month and one next month, all three airplane disaster books. All three of them. Well, when I say airplane disaster books, it's not like they crash. It's really, one's called Hostage by Claire McIntosh, mm-hmm. and it's very clever. And then brilliant. J.T. Newman is called Falling. It's the number one Indie Next pick for July, I think it is. And again, it involves a sort of maybe hijacking, or maybe not. In a way, it's almost a Gothic because it's taking place in an airplane with a captive audience, and you know, it's intimate. It has a threat. It has, you know, but what kind of threat is it? So yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Maybe I'm going to talk about it that way. I thought that the airplane Gothic. Yet another
airplane. There's the
and then there's a third one that's called Falling Down or something similar, which I haven't read. I read the other two, and it too is a book like that. So we're not talking about airplanes.
Not a plane crash.
We're talking about airplanes kind of replacing the country house or the anyway. They're airplane. They're Gothic thrillers set in airplanes. So what
we're coming down to is that. Our definition of a Gothic is coming down to some element of claustrophobia, enclosed claustrophobia, and intimacy, the intimate threat among us, not from outside so much. But
and I think the threat of madness, of destabilization right. as well. I think that has to be a component of it, because
right.
making somebody uneasy, that tension of, wait a second, did I just see that? What was that? You know, that element too, I think, is important.
It has to be a real threat, absolutely. I think destabilization is a good way to phrase it. Well, ladies, this has been a great conversation. I wish that, for those of you watching it, that I have been able to put together a reading list for you, books that you could buy and see what we're talking about. But if you've enjoyed this, you can, I'm trying to think, where should you email? Email me, Barbara@poisonedpen.com, and with suggestions, and maybe we'll come back and we'll do this as a live event where you can participate, and we can give you a reading list, because we can create one and we can put the URL to it in the comments field. So that would be fun. Anyway, this has been great. Thank you both so much. I really enjoyed our emails and conversation. And
thank you.
Let's do it again.
Thank you. Sure. Sounds great.
All right. Bye. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.
Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.